As we begin this class, I want to note that this class, Making Things Right When Things Go Wrong, is based on a book by Paul Faulkner, is where the title of this and some of the materials will be coming from. But when we look at this title, and we look at maybe this image, I think we can all relate to a situation where things have gone wrong, right? Has anything ever gone wrong in your life before? That's like asking if you breathe, right? I mean, it's like, it's very common. So this is something that affects everybody. But the question is how do we deal with it? How do we deal with it? How do other people typically respond when things go wrong? Because, you know, for us, you know, we got things under control. But how do other people deal with things when things go wrong? Any ideas?
Anger.
That's what other people deal with anger when things go wrong. What else? Stress. Maybe this next question kind of helps with that. Do we respond when things go wrong emotionally or logically? Tears, yeah. It's typically mostly emotionally, right? It's that first knee-jerk reaction is emotion kicks in. Very rarely does Spock kick in when things go wrong. It's like, oh, I think this happened. You know, so we very rarely do we do that, right? It's not so emotion really takes over. Do we have a checklist to kind of help keep things in perspective when things go wrong? We're going to be developing that. We're going to be developing some things that we can do to help us when things go wrong. This is not if things go wrong class. This is the when things go wrong class. So we all have lived long enough to know that things will go wrong. And so the first thing we want to look at, when things go wrong, we might want to check our hearts, right? Again, talking about that emotional response, we might want to check our hearts. There's a few passages that deal with this. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, which was something that my parents threw in my face quite often when I was a child. But is it just for children? Is it just, can we relate this to when things go wrong? Do all things, even when they're not going the way we want them to go, do them without grumbling or disputing. Why, according to this passage? Why is this a remedy? So that you'll be blameless, right? So you can prove that you're what? Innocent and children of God. Wait a second. You mean as a child of God, I've got to act different? That there's a standard that I'm being held to? Do all things, whatever it is, without grumbling or disputing. That you'll be innocent, children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Has that changed? Are we still in the midst of that kind of generation? Pretty much that's just a standard operating procedure for most of the world, right? Among whom you appear as lights in the world. Do you think about Matthew 5:16? Show your good works, shine your light, so they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So me not grumbling about a situation that I'm in is me shining as a light in the world. So when I grumble when something happens, what have I done with my light? Boop. I just flipped it off, right? No longer shining. Not shining here. I'm grumbling and disputing. Not shining. And so check our hearts is something that we need to make part of our when things go wrong kit, is checking your heart. For as he thinks within himself, so he is, as New American Standard says. And this is in the context of dealing with somebody who is selfish, but is this not true at all times? How much of what we think actually plays a part in what we do? Zig Ziglar was famous for saying attitude equals altitude. How many of you even know who Zig Ziglar is? Any children of the 80s? Okay. All right, so Zig Ziglar was a motivational speaker for back in the day. But he was famous for attitude equals altitude. And have you find that to be generally true? That an attitude in such a certain situation can make it all the difference? And we'll talk more about that, obviously, tonight. Watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life. If we're not watching over our heart, what kind of spring is coming out? If I'm watching over my heart, springs of life. What kind of life am I having if I'm not watching over it? Just whatever happens, happens. So we need to make sure that we're watching, guarding over our hearts. There was a guy who wanted to buy a spiritual gift as though it was for sale. Simon the Sorcerer, remember? And Peter rebuked him for that. And here at the end of this passage, he says, "For your heart is not right before God. You have no portion in this matter because your heart isn't right." Does it matter where my heart is? That's a Sunday school answer. Yes, right? It does matter where my heart is. It does matter in service to God. And it's Matthew 15. Jesus pointed that out. Their worship was not great. Their attitude, their service to God wasn't great because their heart wasn't there. They were doing this, right? They were speaking the right things, but the heart was not engaged in that. So when things go wrong, we need to check our hearts. When a new king was going to be chosen, one was sent to a family to find the right man who's going to be king. And Samuel saw Eliab, and his comment was what? He saw the oldest son and said, "That's him. That's got to be the guy, right?" He was this Atlas figure, well-chiseled chin, perhaps a cleft. We don't know, right? But he looked like a king. What did God say? Nope, not him. Right? Where was God looking? Was he looking at the figure of the individual? He was looking at the heart. I want a king who has a heart like mine. And he chose this ruddy kid coming in, the last, the seventh son of seven sons, to be the king. Right? And so we talk about David and all the things that David has done. And we look at what God saw in the heart of David. It's very important that we see the urgency of making sure, again, going back to guarding our heart, there's urgency in making sure our heart is where it needs to be. Can we hide our hearts from God? No, we can't. Our hearts are always before Him. Can you hide your attitude from people? Maybe to some degree. I've tried it. Didn't work so good. I thought I was hiding my attitude. I thought nobody knew that I was upset about something. When it came down to it, everybody knew. Right? I was only trying to fool myself. Right? People know. Right? So we need to make sure that our heart is engaged in a way that can bring honor and glory to God. So in looking at this, thinking of David, King David, go to 1 Samuel chapter 17. And we're not going to read all of this. Obviously, I think it's maybe a lesson you've heard once or twice. But I want to come at it from the standpoint of attitude. Attitude. And 1 Samuel chapter 17, any guesses as to what we're dealing with? 1 Samuel chapter 17, specifically verses 26 through 37. This is the chapter when what? David and Goliath, right? This is a big power chapter, right? Everybody loves preaching this one. Even people who don't believe in the Bible love preaching this concept, right? David and Goliath. Now, as the scene opens, David's going to bring, some food to his brothers, some bread, perhaps some nice cheese wheels, we don't know what, but bringing food to his brothers, right? And he goes down to the line, the battle line, to see his brothers and greet them and talk amongst them. And what happens every day at a certain time?
Goliath comes out,
right? And everybody there was what? What did Goliath instill in the armies of Israel? Fear. Everybody was afraid. And then David comes and starts asking questions, right? He starts asking questions about, hey, what's the king going to do if somebody kills this guy, right? If somebody kills him. In verse 26, he says, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine who takes away the approach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God, right? So he comes running in and has this kind of, everybody else is afraid. David comes in and says, hey, so what do I get if I kill this guy, right? So he's How does his brother, how does Eliab respond to David? There's the older brother, verse 28, older brother. Here comes the youngest brother in here, thinks he's all that. He doesn't know how it really works, right? He was mad at him. He chastises him. He says, you know, not only does he say, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? He's making fun of him, right? That's what older brothers do, regrettably. So he's making fun of him, and then he says, well, I know exactly why you're here. You just want to come down and see the battle, and you think you know anything. But then word gets back to the king that David is saying this, that David's asking these questions. And the king actually asks for this young shepherd boy to come before him. Do you remember the attitude that David had when he stood before the king? And the king is like, this man's, you're but a youth, and this man's been a warrior from his youth. Do you remember the attitude that David had? Oh, well, okay, if that's what you think, I'll go back to my sheep.
God delivered him.
He already had a resume. David had a resume, right? What was David's resume for being able to be in that battle right now? The bears and the lions. Now, I don't know about you, but you've not tended many sheep. I don't tend sheep. But I've never been attacked by a bear, have you? A lion? A small dog, perhaps, but not a bear or a lion. Now, those would ruin your day, right? I can mark that. That's a horrible day. You come in from tending the sheep, and you'll say, oh, man, I got attacked by a bear this time. It could be bad. And then a lion the next day. It could be bad. But what did he say? Did he mark it up as something bad? God delivered me out of the mouth of the lion, of the paw of the bear, and he's going to help me kill this uncircumcised Philistine, right? He's 10 feet tall at that moment. Because why? God, obviously, but his attitude was very different. If any one of those men in that line had the faith of David, and have said the same things that day, I'm convinced that God would have been with them as well. But it was David who had the attitude that it doesn't matter. God's with me. We're going to do this. We've done it before, and we'll do it again. So David, in that moment, was in the right place, the right time, with the right attitude. On top of the world, right? But there was another time when he was not in such the right place. You go to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. He was in the wrong place in the wrong time. Where was he in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 11 in 2 Samuel? He's back in the palace. What does the text tell us normally happened that time of year?
Spring when kings go out to war.
And his men were already out in battle. His men were already out there. So he's in the wrong place at the wrong time. Why do you think it's the wrong time? Verse 2. He saw Bathsheba. Now, let me just say this. The text does not say this. This is just me thinking. He goes out on the roof. He woke up from, maybe he was late at night, and he woke up and he went out on the roof. Right? He got up from his bed is what it says. Do you think it was coincidence that this happened? Do ladies bathe on a regular basis? Men, do ladies bathe on it? Yes, they bathe on it. And are we thankful that they bathe on it? Yes, we are thankful they bathe on a regular basis. Could it be he knew that was going to be the case? We don't know. We don't know. But he went out there, and he saw what he shouldn't have seen. What was his attitude? Look in verse 3. What was his attitude? He had to have. He wanted to know more. Who is this lady, right? He wanted to know more. What should he have done? What would have been the most decent thing to do?
Turn around,
go back to bed, say your prayers, right? You know, that would be the thing he should have done. But he went down a path he shouldn't have gone down. He should not have asked questions, and he kept, and then he brought, you know, we know what happened. Now, David did change. He had the wrong attitude here, but when he was confronted with this, and David or Nathan said, "Thou art the man," in 2 Samuel, this is the next chapter, verse chapter 12, "Thou art the man," and he used sheep, you know. You can get to David's heart, you start talking about sheep. And he changed, he repented. If the headings in the Psalms are correct, Psalm 51, verse 4 says, "Against you and you only have I sinned." There was this penitence that he had. He showed it there, and he showed it through his life, this penitence. But in that moment, his attitude, the attitude made the difference in those two situations. His attitude could have been right, and he could have turned away and chose to honor God and shy away from those things, but it didn't. He chose the wrong thing in that moment. I want to talk about kind of our predisposition. Have you noticed that there are certain people who are predisposed sometimes to, when things go wrong, they might be a little more chill than others? Have you noticed that? I'll tell you what, kids pick up on that, right? Kids pick up on that. If you're going to share bad news in your household and you're the child, then you have to tell your parents, because them finding out from some other source is just even worse. Have you been there? Okay. Who do you choose to tell that information to? Break it softly. Usually mom, right? Mom was the one I went to. You know, dads are predisposed sometimes to maybe not handle the situation, or at least not the way I want it to be handled. And that not be always the case, but in my household, I would share it with mom. It was an easy open, right? Soft open with mom, and then dad, right? So sometimes some people are predisposed. But when we talk about our predisposition to respond, can y'all read that? Is that too small? Okay. So personality is a sum total of mental characteristics that makes an individual unique. You are you because of what it says here, heredity and environment, right? And so on a very superficial level, personality comes throughout through one's disposition or emotional tone. However, personality is also reflected in values, beliefs, expectations of a person. So why are we talking about this? I am predisposed to respond to wrong things because of heredity, that is nature, just how I was pre-programmed, born, and then certain circumstances in my life, nature and nurture. We are all predisposed to respond to information a certain way, based on those two characteristics, based on those two factors. And it says values, emotional tone, whereas values, beliefs, and expectations are a result of experiences and socialization that a person has had in his or her childhood. Now, if you don't have kids, maybe one day you will, or you have kids, or you have grandkids, but maybe you've picked up on this. Our children learn how to handle things based on how we handle things. Have you noticed that? If mom and dad are chill, cool, copacetic through things that are going on, children will be cool as well. They're taught. Now, in general, that is the case. We teach how to handle issues by how we handle them. And in doing so, we need to be aware of these things. How many of you have said something or handled a situation the way perhaps your parents or your parents handled something? I've been there. I've done things I said I would never do. Said the things that my father said to me I swore I would never say. But I said them. It's not necessarily right or wrong. It's just what happens. Now, the thing is, we can't hide behind this. One famous philosopher once said, "I'm not bad, I was just drawn that way." Roger Rabbit, nobody? Okay, anyway, moving on. So there is a situation, and we can't hide behind this. We can't hide behind this. We can't say that, well, that's just how I am. Have you heard that? That's just me. That's just how I am. That's just how I roll. You can take it or leave it. Is that how we need to respond to things? No, by no means. Predisposition can change. Can change by a renewing of your mind, Romans chapter 12, verse 3. There is that renewing we're supposed to have as Christians. Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9 gives us a list of things to think about. Think on these things. If you're thinking on these things, this passage tells us it'll be difficult for you to stumble. So in Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9, we have this list. And then 2 Peter as well has this list. If these qualities are yours, what I was referring to, 1 Peter. So if I recognize that I'm predisposed to maybe not handle a certain situation very well, should I work on that? When things go wrong, if I know that I get super anxious, I, you know, panic eat, or, you know, whatever it is, whatever it is that how you deal with when things go wrong, when you start looking at our heart and filling our heart and working on our heart to make sure that at least starting there, I have a good starting point. Starting there, I have a good starting point. My attitude about things that are going wrong is different. We can't hide behind our predisposition and say, well, that's my excuse. That's just how I handle things. We can't do that. And Galatians chapter 5 also has this list of things that we need to be working on in order to be changing our heart and keeping our heart engaged. Now, is that something that we can do on a regular basis? Sure. Look at Galatians chapter 5. Let's go there real quick before we move on from here. Galatians chapter 5. How many of you know the fruits of the Spirit by heart? How many of you know the song? Can you say it without singing it? It helps to sing it, right? The list, okay. I still sing it. It's fun. So anyway, verse 22. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, and peace. Those three alone would be helpful, right? Love, joy, and peace. Patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness. Here's a biggie, self-control. Would these not help if we're working on these in our life? Would these not help when things go wrong? Guess how we work on these things? When things go wrong, right? You're not working on this when you're in peacetime, right? You're not like when things are chill and everything's good and you think you have everything under control. We're not working on those things. Guess when we're working on them? When things are in your face and life is going is crazy, that's when you get to work on them. It's when you get to work on them. We get to exercise. Nobody exercises when it doesn't hurt, right? We exercise these things. So working on these things are gonna help keep our heart in check and be able to handle these things when they come up. There's a couple examples of this in the New Testament. We have a resilient attitude in Matthew chapter 15. You may know this story, Matthew chapter 15. There is a woman who is asking, has an ask from Jesus. Beginning of verse 21, Jesus went away from there, and a widow, and withdrew rather, into the district of Tyre and Sidon. And a Canaanite woman from the region came out and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David, my daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." Now, why is it important that we mention that she's a Canaanite woman? Why is that important detail here? She's not an Israelite. That comes into play in the next verse, right? But he did not answer her with a word. What do we call that? Ignoring, silent treatment, right? She's crying out. Now, in my mind, it's not just her and the disciples, right? There's a throng of people around A throng of people. That means a lot. There's a lot of people around Jesus. And she's crying out. She wants help. She's in this great need. We see that need concerning her daughter. And we think about our children, there wouldn't be anything we wouldn't do for our children, especially in this case. And it's not that she just has a demon and, you know, it's, you know, pea soup every once in a while. It says, my daughter is cruelly demon-possessed. She's more than just projectile vomiting, right? This is not The Exorcist. She's cruelly demon-possessed. And so she's there with this great need. Jesus does not answer her. What do the disciples say? Send her away. She keeps shouting at us. She keeps shouting at us. So she was denied and then denied a second time. But she came and began to bow down before him, saying, Lord, help me. She knew exactly where she needed to go. What was Jesus' response? In verse 27 and 28. How did he respond to her? Yes. In verse 28, O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as for you as you wish. And her daughter was healed at once. She is this great example of faith. Now, obviously, in this moment, Jesus was not just being mean, right? Did he know her heart? Did he know to what extent she would be asking for help? Of course. Did the disciples need to see that from her? The disciples needed to see that. Do we need to see that? Lord, help me. Do we need to see that? Obviously we do. It's here. Because we need to see it. We need to see that. So when things are going wrong, we need to have a resilient attitude. We need to keep praying, keep bringing things before God, keep that attitude up. There's another example in Luke 15, the chapter of lost things. There's a couple of lost boys, I guess, if you want to go that far with it. What do we call this typically? The parable of what? The prodigal son. Prodigal son. It's as much about the prodigal son as it is the perfect son. It's as much, it's about both. Well, it's about more than that. But anyway, what I want to look at is the prodigal son had a rotten to right attitude, right? What was his rotten attitude? How did he start off? Selfish. Give me my money. Give me what I deserve. And then he did what with it? What do we know? He goes off into the far country and he wastes all that on riotous living, and he's, what point does he come to his senses, does the text say? Starving to death, he'd eat with pigs, right? Which is the grossest thing ever. He would eat what pigs would eat. And that's when he comes to his senses and says, how many of my father's servants are better taken care of? So he goes from son to servant, and his a son that deserves to a servant who would just serve, and I'll go back and serve. And the father says, you can be my son, right? But there was a son who was there all along, right? And maybe he had the right attitude, maybe not, but he was there all along. What was his right to rotten attitude? What happened with him? There's jealous, there was not happy. The text tells us he was angry about what was going on. Did he need to be angry? What was everybody else doing when the son came back? Everybody else was rejoicing. The text tells the servants are saying, your brother, your brother, your brother, over and over again in the text to this son. Hey, your brother's returned. Your father did this. Your brother has returned. It's so exciting. This is great. He became angry. Why did he become angry? What does the text say? What is he saying? He felt slighted. Why? Why did he feel slighted? I've been good this whole time. I've been here. You never killed a fatted calf for me and my friends when we wanted to hang out for the weekend. But for this brother who wasted all the money on prostitutes, I'm sure, and gambling, you give him this. But I'm here the whole time, and you didn't give me anything. You didn't do anything for me. What is this attitude? What is this? The idea is I deserve these things because I was here the whole time. I deserve them. What's this? What's the real secret here concerning God?
He wants all to be saved.
He wants all to be saved, forgiveness, and do any of us deserve it? No. None of us deserve the gracious, loving kindness and mercies of God. None of us deserve that. So where others were rejoicing, his rotten attitude had him being angry. Do you see the attitude changes here? Yes, sir. So there's more there than what we can see, and there's evidence to suggest that maybe from the beginning he didn't have the right attitude, this other brother. It is a very deep score. That's why it's lots of sermons on this one. But it does communicate to us the concept of arrogance to repentance, and that, you know, how much of an attitude makes a difference in our relationship with God. The attitude of arrogance sends us off into the far country. He was going to have more to start with, yes. Yeah.
So he kind of
I would say yes, right? He got a frowny sticker on his attitude. So his concept of what was going on was not right. This was his brother that was coming back. So maybe there's some animosity there, but, you know, we're reading. Go ahead. Yes. Oh, my. That's not fair. Yeah, that's just not fair. What's the response to fair? To that? Well, that's not fair. How should we respond to that? Life's not fair, buttercup. Right? That's just how it is, right? But when we look at this, we can think about attitudes in things. And maybe we've been the older brother. Maybe we've been that. Well, I can think of it as an instance specifically when I've been the older brother. I think about in grade school, I lived on a street, and there was a family he was a bully at school. Do y'all remember the bully at school? The bully. Dun, 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 right? And I saw my principal bought him new shoes. He was going around bragging about the principal bought him new shoes. And I actually went and talked to the principal. I went and talked to him and said, that's not fair. Are you buying this guy new shoes? And he's like, don't you live on his street? And I said, yes, sir. But in my mind, I'm thinking that's beside the point. Why are we bringing up our address? Have you walked by his house? Every day, I walked by his house to go to school, which was uphill both ways, by the way. It was in the low valley. Okay. Half a mile, if you're asking. Anyway, so every day we walked by his house. Said, you've seen the house then. It was in disarray. Not a healthy family life. And there was a reason why he was a bully. And I said, well, he doesn't deserve it. And the principal said, none of us deserve it. But he needed that. It's the same thing for us. There's a lot of things that we don't deserve. You can see people, the undesirables that Jesus went to, they didn't deserve his attention, but God went to them. And in this case, the attitude makes all the difference. My attitude needed to change. It wasn't about what he or I deserved. It was about what was needed in that moment. What was needed was to kill the fatted calf. What was needed was to rejoice that the brothers come home, not to have the attitude, well, I deserve more. I deserve that. So attitude helps, and it's up to us. Look at 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians. Paul had a lot of reasons why his attitude could have been bad. When Paul was talking about this thorn in his flesh, And he says he asked, you know, over and over again for it to be removed. We don't know what it was. But he, capital H, Jesus, said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distress, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then I am strong." That's not a popular attitude. Not a popular attitude. Can you think about sitting on a stone floor chained to a Roman soldier? Would that be fun? Probably not. How many of you sat on a stone floor for very long? What happens? How many of you sat on a floor for very long? Forget stone. Your legs start going to sleep, right? Yes. Your cushion starts to feel like less of a cushion. It hurts. There's all kinds of reasons why Paul could have been grumbling and disputing the situation he found himself in. But he says, I am well content with my weaknesses, with the things that are going on, with insults, with distresses. I'm content. What did James say in James chapter 1, verse 2? "Consider it all joy, my brother, when you fall into various trials." That is not the attitude that we normally have. Things are going wrong. That's great. Opportunity to grow. Opportunity for change. Opportunity. We don't think that way. Philippians chapter 4. Beginning of verse 11, "Not that I speak from want, for I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances." Now, did Paul grow up? Was Paul born and his parents were like, "He's just the most content baby ever. He's just super content, no matter what happens." Of course not. He learned to be content. How do you learn to be content? Any ideas? Maybe change your attitude. That's the right answer for this class. Maybe change your attitude. What else?
You have to go without.
You said there's circumstances where? Yeah, just the pain of the situations. I've just got to deal with this, right? I think there's a phrase that goes around. It is what it is, right? I can't really change it. Can't do with it, but I can change me, right? Exactly. Put things in perspective. In Paul's mind, he was putting his life in perspective as a life served for Christ. If Christ is glorified in my weaknesses, bring him on. Bring on the insults. Bring it on. If Christ is glorified because of what I'm going through, I'll go through some more. We can keep doing this. I can do it all night, right? So he keeps saying, I've learned to be content. For I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity, just in case you're wondering. If any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. This passage, verse 13, is not about high school graduation. It is about me being able to bear up under things because I'm content, and no matter what happens in my life, no matter what happens, no matter what circumstances are going on, I can be content. I can do all those things because, again, it goes back to the power of Christ dwells in me and is shown for because of the situation I'm in. And that can only happen when my attitude is in the right place, when things go wrong. Now, just because we've had this class and you've been told that attitude is the first key to success in dealing with when things go wrong, I'm going to go out and my whole life has changed. Is that? Of course not, because what do we have to do now? And we probably already knew this coming in. How many of you knew this going into the class? This might be something we want to talk about when things go wrong. Probably knew coming in. It's maybe just a reminder that attitude is important. Now we have to go out and practice it. It's easy to sit in here and talk about it. But now we got to go out and actually do it. And that's when it gets difficult. Are y'all waiting on me for the bell? Or are we good? We got 1 minute. Any thoughts, questions, concerns, comments? Yes, sir. Yes, very much so. Exactly. Yes, we're not doing it alone. Christ is there with us. I've read somewhere about bearing one another's burdens, something like that, somewhere. So there is that kind of general familial help, unless they're your burden. So then maybe we'll talk about that another class. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yes. Did y'all hear that? Self-awareness requires that I know I have a bad attitude, right? And I'm aware of it. And it's okay for us to talk about the fact that I have a bad attitude. Are you okay with somebody coming to you and say, you might have had a bad attitude in that situation? Oh, no, I didn't. All right. so maybe that's step one, right? The awareness of the fact that I have an attitude I need to work on. If I'm sitting here and I'm like, oh, everything's perfect, I'm great, nothing's wrong. Okay. All right. But that's a very good point. Self-awareness is very important in dealing with this. Thank you all very much for your time tonight, and hopefully this study will be helpful to you.